This is the Cato Daily Podcast for Thursday, January 12, 2023. I'm Caleb Brown. The United States is pretty special when it comes to the protection of a broad conception of the freedom of speech. In many other countries, either insulting the government or the dominant religion can land you in jail. And in China, even protesting with blank sheets of paper sends a very clear message about the restriction of a basic liberty. Jacob Michangama is author of Free Speech, A History from Socrates to Social Media. We spoke last week. The United States, of course, has had a long and for a while, I guess, uncertain struggle with respect to speech, but the First Amendment appears to be pretty clear. This U.S. Supreme Court seems to be pretty clear in its interpretation of it. Internationally, how special is the U.S. with respect to speech?
Well, there certainly is a very real degree of free speech exceptionalism in the U.S., especially when it comes to what we might call viewpoint absolutism. So, for instance, no government restrictions on hate speech unless it reaches some fairly high thresholds. And in general, it takes a lot for the government to be allowed to restrict free speech in the U.S. as opposed to the European Union, for instance, where all member states are obliged to prohibit certain types of hate speech. That this also follows from international human rights law and is integrated in all European democracies in their criminal laws. So in that sense, the U.S. is definitely an outlier.
And in terms of public attitudes, of course, I've spoken with Cato's Emily Eakins about public attitudes in the United States, and we sort of came to the conclusion that everybody in America loves free speech right up until somebody says something they don't like.
That's also what we found. So my organization, the Future Free Speech Project, did a survey of attitudes towards free speech in 33 countries around the globe in 2021. And we did actually sort of a composite measure, if you like, of attitudes towards free speech in those countries. And I think the U.S. came in at fourth, whereas the Nordic countries sort of generally outperformed. But we're talking about tiny differences. But it's very true. Actually, even globally, if you ask people around the world globally whether they think free speech is very important, everyone says, yes, free speech is very important. But then you ask them about supposedly conflicting values, and then you see huge differences in degrees of tolerance towards free speech.
So around the world, then, how do attitudes differ among the public?
Yeah. So, for instance, if you go to Islamic countries, Muslim majority countries, you will generally see a very low degree of tolerance for religious offense. So no blasphemy, please. Whereas in most Western countries, you will see a high degree of tolerance of that. You will also see that in countries like Russia, for instance, there's a very low degree of tolerance for speech that is denigrates the national flag, for instance, which also in Western countries, tolerance is higher. But you also see differences within Western countries. So Germany, for historical reasons, probably has a very low degree of tolerance for speech that is offensive to minorities, whereas in the U.S. and also Scandinavian countries, that degree of tolerance rises to, above 60%. But generally, you can make some sort of general differences depending on culture, for instance, between countries and the degree of tolerance for speech.
And you said no blasphemy, please, but that's putting it mildly when it comes to how a lot of Muslim majority countries handle what they deem to be blasphemy.
That is true. So I think I don't know the latest number, but the last number I think I saw was that around a dozen or so Muslim majority countries had formal death penalty for blasphemy and or apostasy. Now these death penalties are very rarely executed. But, you know, if you're someone like Raif Badawi, for instance, the Saudi Arabian free thinker who wrote sort of skeptical, atheistic things on his blog, he still spent a long time in prison, was sentenced to 1,000 lashes, and is now living in house arrest somewhere. And, you know, you have people languishing on death row in Pakistan for Facebook comments or even sort of neighborly disputes between religious minorities and different religious groups that can result in blasphemy charges. So that's a very low degree of tolerance for blasphemy, yes.
So, you know, if you can, is there really a difference in states that crack down on speech? I know in some Muslim-majority countries, it's speech against Islam. In China, for example, we have the example of Jimmy Lau and Apple Daily of against the regime. Is there much of a difference in a lot of these countries?
Well, very often in countries that punish blasphemy, and that was certainly also the case in Western Europe up until not that many centuries ago, and even in colonial America, where blasphemy could be punished severely, religion and politics tend to blend together. So criticizing religion is tantamount to criticizing the government, and vice versa. So now you see, for instance, in Iran, some of the protesters against the regime are being punished, sentenced to death for waging war against God. And of course, waging war against God means going against the theocratic regimes. And let's not forget that many, they may be atheists, but some of them might also just be heterodox Muslims who don't want to live in a theocratic regime, who wants a more secular state, even if they may still be religious.
What do you make of these protests in China? I believe they're called the white paper protests or blank paper protests, where people are just holding up blank sheets of paper as a means of protest.
Yeah, I think it's an ingenious picture into how it's impossible for even the most totalitarian state to completely crack down on all types of dissent, because people will use will contextualize and use clever devious way of undermining censorship, and of course it also you basically force the regime to show its true colors if it throws people in prison for holding up a blank piece of paper. The same thing happened in Russia when it was banned to call the invasion of Ukraine a war. People would ultimately stand with blank pieces of paper, and they would be carried away by burly Russian security forces. So I think that it's a clever way of really demonstrating the lens to which authoritarian regimes are willing to crack down on free speech in order to ensure their hold on power.
It really is brilliant, and it brings into very sharp relief the degree to which a state is wants to exert its own power. What are the biggest problems that you see with speech around the world? You know, to the extent that attitudes are somewhat, but there are countries where speech is not respected, not given protection by the state, and yet there is this broad public desire for fewer restrictions on the ability of people to speak to one another.
Yeah, so I think there, so broadly speaking, democracy and free speech has been in decline for more than a decade. And those two things go hand in hand. Free speech would typically be the very first freedom that an authoritarian regime, or one that aims to be an authoritarian regime, will crack down on. It's sort of page one in the 101 on how to become a dictator. So that's a very old and classic example. Then I think in democracies, the problem is slightly different. So we mentioned in the beginning that in the United States, the law has probably never afforded a stronger protection of speech than is the case today under the current interpretation of the First Amendment. Now, that has not always been the case. But arguably, the culture of free speech sustaining sort of the civil libertarian ethos that sustains this understanding of the First Amendment, I think, is fraying around the edges due to polarization in the U.S. So if you ask Republicans and Democrats about their red lines on free speech, you will see that they follow sort of partisan lines. And that is, I think, quite unhealthy for the long-term flourishing of free speech protection, because if those who are who will be the future legal guardians of the free speech are sort of educated to view free speech with suspicion, or if the judiciary becomes completely sort of partisan, then the current understanding of the First Amendment is unlikely to hold ground. And the First Amendment has changed a lot over time. You don't have to go back very far before, you know, in the 50s, where it was okay to punish people for being members of socialist or communist parties, for instance, or for southern states to crack down on the civil rights movements and their protests against white supremacy and so on. So free speech exceptionalism might have been baked into the wording of the First Amendment, but it certainly has not been baked in from the very beginning into sort of the institutions and sort of the judicial decisions of the Supreme Court in the U.S., in U.S. history.
So, you know, I quote, this quote just sticks with me for, or has for a long time, which is Greg Lukianoff saying, you know, how am I better off not knowing what you really think? And so I wonder, to what extent can we re-energize the desire among at least Americans to accept fully, to embrace fully the grand bargain that a robust freedom of speech gives us?
Yeah, no, I think first of all, you need, well, maybe not first of all, but you certainly need truly principled defenders of free speech, and Greg Lukianoff and FIRE, which is now the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression. And full disclosure, I'm a senior fellow there. But I think, you know, their expanded mission aims to do that. And so I think it's extremely important that free speech defenders are not seen as, you know, being a sort of a cover for one or the other sides. They have to be equally annoying to the right and the left and everyone else, and be equally condemning when you know it's Republicans or Democrats or independents who pose a threat to free speech. And then I think, you know, in the U.S. today, many progressives and liberals have become suspicious about free speech, where they used to arguably be sort of its core constituency, because they view free speech as being a threat to minorities, to democracy, and so on. And that, to me, is, you know, an incredibly shallow reading of American history. When you see who has benefited from free speech, has been overwhelmingly marginalized, persecuted groups, racial, political minorities, women, and so on. And, you know, I don't think you magically reached a point in American history where you can say, oh, we reached a perfect equilibrium. Free speech was a nice principle. Now, you know, we need to dilute the protection a little bit because we want to protect the perfect nirvana that we've reached. No, all human beings are liable to fall prey to what I call Milton's curse, the selective, unprincipled defense of free speech, and the principle of, or sort of the process of free speech entropy, which sort of posits that free speech will and the commitment to free speech will sort of dilute over time, and will be tempted by those in power will be tempted to use their powers to justify restrictions on free speech. And I think you see that in the U.S. But you also see it on the other side, right? I think conservatives have had a reasonable cause to lament about so-called cancel culture in universities and elite institutions. But then what is the answer? It's Republican-dominated legislatures adopting various laws to restrict viewpoints in higher education and so on, which is a frontal assault on the First Amendment and is hardly the way to go about defending free speech. So I think you need these kinds of institutions and people who are vocally and preferably people from all kinds of sides with very different ideas about the common good, but who are united in the belief that free speech is the antithesis of violence and the only means on which you can actually compromise. You need radical free speech in order to be able to be pragmatic and compromise in the realm of politics, and also just in the realms of human flourishment. You know, that you know, you can live with your neighbors, your spouse, your friends, your colleagues, and disagree vehemently about politics and religions and religion and philosophy, but you know, you don't need to go to war because you can actually discuss these things amongst yourselves. And that was not the case going back a few hundred years, even in the American colonies, where you know, you have terrible records of people being, you know, whipped and branded for having the wrong religious ideas. You know, even some of the great founders had, you know, fell prey to Milton's curse and were perfectly happy to punish those who said seditious things. So being aware of the significance and importance of free speech to foundational values of America, including tolerance and respect for minorities, is, I think, also crucial to sort of reconstructing the bulwark of liberty, which free speech really is.
Yeah, because I imagine, and you make note of this in your book, you know, imagine a world in which Frederick Douglass was never allowed to give speeches around the country, yeah, lamenting, and, you know, lamenting the horrors of slavery.
Yeah, no, exactly. And there were, of course, I mean, Frederick Douglass could not, you know, travel to the South and give a speech. If he did that, he would be immediately arrested. And he would probably be returned to his quote unquote slave owner. So he couldn't do that. And he held, so he had to do it in the North. And he, you know, in 1860, he gave a speech in Boston that was attacked by white Bostonians who were not happy with abolitionist ideas, and that's when he penned this fabulous speech called A Plea for Free Speech in Boston, which I think today, if you read it, it's only like two pages. It really answers all contemporary attacks on free speech, both, you know, those from the government, but also those from private individuals, and also talks about something which is often forgotten, that free speech is not only the right of the individual speaker, but it's also the right of the wider community to be able to listen to different viewpoints and make up their own minds. And also, as you attributed to Greg Lukianoff, sort of, you know, identify potential threats. How do you know, you know, if there are dangers to your local community or to the Republic if you don't, you know, if you're unable to detect those signals that people send out when they say extreme things. Frederick Douglass is one of the great heroes of mine. Ida B. Wells is another person. I mean, I don't think few people have been as brave. So she's basically sets up a black-owned newspaper in Memphis, Tennessee, documenting lynchings and sort of giving the true stories, and she ultimately, her newspaper is burned to the ground, and she has to flee because a white mob wants to kill her, basically. And she's also very adamant about the importance of free speech, so even her newspaper is called the Memphis Free Speech. And you know, you could go on and on, you know, go back less than 100 years, women suffragettes in the U.S. were arrested for burning an effigy, you know, I think it was Woodrow Wilson protesting against the lack of voting rights for women. So their rights to free speech was being denied, and the right to free speech, of course, was decisive in ultimately securing the right to vote for women. But I think a lot of people convinced themselves that, well, yeah, these were really worthy causes. Free speech was important for that. But now we don't want to. You know, we can distinguish other groups from that, and we don't need to uphold free speech for those. But I think the early pioneers of free speech saw very clearly that you actually need to uphold free speech for extremists in order to uphold free speech for all.
Do you have a sense that a lot of the opposition to freedom of speech in the United States takes sort of a, I don't know, regulatory tack? That is, well, we're going to use these other tools of regulation in the U.S. We have a massive regulatory state, and we're going to use that to lean on people in private industry and say, you must get rid of this speech, and you must allow this speech over here.
It seems to me that, you know, private institutions are doing a lot of speech policing, whether, you know, it's universities and of course now social media platforms. And it's interesting with the so-called Twitter files, which of course, true to form, were instantly sort of being interpreted through partisan lenses. One side sort of saw them as evidence of collusion and sort of almost fascism, and the other as a big nothing burger. I tend to see them as not that surprising, but still revealing that governments will use informal channels to lean on the basic infrastructure of the modern public digital square, which I think is a very unhealthy development, because first of all, it blurs the line of the First Amendment protections, and it also happens without any scrutiny and transparency. So that is certainly a concern. And of course, now it seems that there are also these laws being adopted in various states trying to regulate social media, and I think they leave big question marks about the robustness of free speech in the digital sphere going forward. So it'll be very interesting to see how federal courts come down on this question.
Jacob Michangama is author of Free Speech, A History from Socrates to Social Media. It's a new year, and I want to thank everyone who supported the Cato Podcast sponsor program with a gift. You can do so as well. It's never too late. Visit cato.org/podcast sponsor, and thank you.